Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, back in March, Governor Ron DeSantis held what he called a roundtable discussion on public health. He invited four doctors to take part and asked them some questions. These four doctors have all been supporters of the governor's pandemic strategy of reopening the economy in the spring and also reopening schools.
The roundtable lasted almost 2 hours, but it was this statement in question by the governor about 25 minutes into that discussion that has sparked two controversies.
Dr. Gupta mentioned about, you know, not putting masks on kids. That's not effective, not necessary. Martin Calder, do you agree in school there's no need for them to be wearing face masks?
Now, the quartet of doctors the governor had gathered argued masks were not necessary for children. The governor cited guidance from the World Health Organization during this March roundtable. What the WHO in December said was this: children up to 5 years old should not wear masks for source control. For kids 6 to 11 years old, the WHO guidance was the decision about mask wearing should be based on how well the child can wear a mask appropriately, the intensity of the virus transmission, and settings such as, quote, households with elderly relatives or schools, end quote. The health organization went on to say in December that kids 12 and older should follow the same mask wearing principles as adults.
Then last week, here's what happened next. YouTube pulled down the video of the governor's roundtable over those comments about kids and masks. YouTube said it removed the video because it included, quote, content that contradicts the consensus of local and global health authorities. Now, as part of its rationale, YouTube specifically cited several instances where the panelists on the video condemned mask wearing for kids, despite the public health guidance from the CDC and the World Health Organization. The panel argued that masks were ineffective in limiting the spread of the virus. Also, central to the panel's purpose was promoting the idea of what's known as immunity through infection. It calls for lifting COVID-related restrictions and, in effect, letting the virus run its course for low-risk Americans under the age of 60. That idea was first proposed in the Great Barrington Declaration, a joint letter co-signed by three of the panelists who appeared with the governor. Last year, dozens of researchers wrote a joint letter in the esteemed medical journal The Lancet to unilaterally condemn the practice of immunity through infection as what they called a dangerous fallacy unsupported by scientific evidence. Now, the governor struck back at YouTube on Monday.
Now, they say it's misinformation, even though Google and YouTube routinely host conspiracy theory videos ranging from the cause of the 9/11 attacks to the role that 5G networks play in causing COVID-19.
Now, the action by YouTube and its parent company, Google, opens a new front in the governor's fight with social media technology firms like Twitter and Facebook. In January, he said his top legislative priority this year was to prevent censorship of conservatives on social media. A bill under consideration now would level state fines against companies like Twitter, Facebook, and Google if they block users and political candidates.
A little later on here on the Florida Roundup, we'll take a closer look at the political ramifications of the governor's stance on mask wearing for youngsters and COVID-19. But first, we begin with a look at what the science says as we talk to a leading pediatric expert. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call here on the show. The number to join us, 305-995-1800, or tweet us at Florida Roundup.
Dr. Jeffrey Goldhagen is Professor and Chief Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at the University of Florida College of Medicine, Jacksonville. He's also President, International Society for Social Pediatrics and Child Health. Doctor, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Nice to have you today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
So let's just start here. What is the guidance for children and the wearing of masks to slow the spread of COVID-19?
Well, so it's very clear that children are, in fact, at risk from COVID-19. They are at risk for having side effects. They are at risk for having significant side effects. They're at risk for their multi-system inflammatory disease. They're at risk for dying from COVID, albeit for sure that risk is less than adults, And in fact, as we saw the surge over the last month or so in cases in general, we've also seen the surge in number of cases for children and number of hospitalizations for children. So the misperception or misconception that children are not at risk is critically wrong, is profoundly wrong, and it puts children at significant risk. As far as the issues related to masks and the effectiveness for mask wearing amongst children, it has the same effectiveness as for adults. And so the panel's discussion about vulnerability, which I think is in a sense deplorable, they make a statement that they're in the Great Barrington Declaration that there are populations of people that are not vulnerable. And in fact, that is critically wrong, and children are vulnerable. We've learned much during the trajectory of this pandemic. We thought that schools could be super spreader places. In fact, that probably isn't the case.
Yeah.
Although in Israel, when Israel opened up its schools, they did see significant spread in those environments.
Yeah, Dr. Goldhagen, sorry for the interruption. I want to ask you specifically about schools and the role here, but regarding just kids and masks, the governor, as we mentioned, cited the WHO guidance in December during the governor's March roundtable. He's pointed to that guidance as evidence that masks are not necessary for children. We explained what that guidance was. It was age-based guidance. Why the difference in guidance for different ages, and is there different effectiveness of masks on children of different ages?
No, so the WHO is looking at it from a global perspective and access to masks and so on. The CDC recommends masks at a much lower age, and masks worn appropriately are as effective in children as they are in adults.
The governor and his panel also pointed out that there was, in their mind, no difference in areas that had mask mandates and the transmission of the infection. They pointed to Los Angeles, for instance. They pointed to Miami-Dade County, which has had a mask mandate, as no significant difference on infection rates. How do you hear that criticism in response?
Well, so the children wearing masks, in particular children wearing masks in schools, aren't isolated environments. They are, in fact, environments that exist within the larger environment of communities. And so to isolate the use of masks in children, in particular in schools, outside the context of the communities themselves, where there are many, many other factors happening, is wrong. So we do know that wearing masks, and again, I mentioned Israel, we do know that, in fact, if schools are opened and children are not wearing masks, that, in fact, they can serve as spread the disease, but also they can also become infected by adults in the environment that are spreading the disease as well. So masks do work in children. They're effective in children, both in spreading the disease, but also, as we've learned over the period of the pandemic, they also protect the user as well.
It's 305-995-1800 here on the Florida Roundup. Allie is on the line in Coconut Grove right now. Hey, Allie, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
All right, thanks. Go ahead.
Sure. My comment was as a mother of 2, 7, and 8-year-old boys who last spring saw the effect of having them out of school and just the mental health aspect and how challenging it was for them and what a gift it was the moment they were able to go back to school this fall, and they've been successfully in school all year because of the masks. And so as a parent, I find it appalling that the governor would insist on the non-mask wearing and encourage that, just because I agree that kids should be in school, but the only way we can do this without the constant interruption is the mask wearing. And even at 7 and 8 years old, they do it all day and they do it well.
Allie, thanks for that. Dr. Goldhagen, Governor DeSantis is pointing to his decision to open up classrooms in this state as earlier than some other states as being vindicated. Certainly, most parents are glad to see their children back in school, as Ali said. But at the same time, YouTube took down the video of a sitting governor saying that he was deliberately spreading misinformation over the mask issue with children. Let's get back to that. It's remarkable that that happened to begin with. And as you're saying, the masks are being used in most school districts around the state. And it sounds as though you believe that really has made a difference in tamping down the spread of the virus overall in those communities. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And what's most concerning to me is the fact that Governor DeSantis, in some respects, was willing to sacrifice our children. He was willing to say that children aren't vulnerable, which is a statement that was made by the panel, which is not true. He was willing to put children into harm's way by suggesting that they not wear masks. And he was willing to put them in harm's way in schools that, in fact, would potentially result in the exposure of adults and so on. So he's willing to sacrifice our children, which is a harsh statement to make. But it's a statement that I think is evidence-based. Masks work. They work in children as well as adults, and they do stop the spread. What is true is that schools did not turn out to be the super spreader event that we had anticipated. But that does not mean that children and adults aren't exposed in schools.
Right. There was a Centers for Disease Control study that looked at the virus in Florida public schools, and it found that most infections of school-aged children in Florida were not school-related. It found that higher rates among students were happening in smaller school districts and districts with more kids that were in school buildings and classrooms, as well as in districts that were operating without mandatory mask policies. Now, this week, Doctor, the Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran sent a letter to Florida school superintendents that said, quote, the data shows us that districts' face covering policies do not impact the spread of the virus, end quote. Is that statement true?
Let me go back to what I was, the statement that I made earlier. Face masks work. They work in children as well as they work in adults. The problem is that taking the school systems and the out of the total environment, schools exist within communities, they exist within community environments. And so one can't just isolate a school and the effects of a school without considering what's happening in the environment itself. And But it is true, as I've mentioned, that schools have not become the super spreader events that we had anticipated they would. The other issue is that the majority of cases of COVID in children are asymptomatic. And so we don't know without comprehensive testing initiatives which kids have actually contracted the disease and which haven't, and which kids are spreading it within their communities, and in particular within their homes.
Homes. And if
those
I
kind of statements are not, can't be made.
Yeah. Stephanie in Palm Coast. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a nurse, and I know how masks work in my world. And extrapolating that out into the real world, I don't understand how anybody can say they don't work or advocate not using them when it is the single easiest, most comprehensive mode of infection prevention. And my problem is it seems like it's not, the medical aspect is absolutely being sacrificed on the altar of Governor DeSantis's cause celeb, which is, looking as much like Donald Trump as he possibly can, which is, spitting on masks and spitting on science.
Stephanie, thanks for the call. Let's talk about the politics of this as we bring in a new voice. It's Stephen Limoncello, politics editor with the Orlando Sentinel. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, going off Stephanie's comment, political analysts such as yourself do believe the governor is looking to boost his national profile by likening himself to former President Trump. After YouTube pulled that video down, he actually doubled down on associating himself with those medical advisors and held another conference with them. He is topping presidential preference polls among Republican primary voters and raising a lot of money as well. So how do you see his approach to the pandemic response, although controversial, impacting his presidential aspirations in a Republican primary?
Sure. So, yeah, the YouTube thing essentially played into, two of DeSantis's things that he's been sort of pushing recently, both, big tech is going after conservatives, and also his sort of being the standard bearer around the country as sort of the most, anti-COVID response or anti-COVID restriction governor in the country. And you're right, he essentially doubled down immediately as soon as this the YouTube news came down, gathered three of the four people who were on the panel, the three people, in fact, who were specifically listed by YouTube as having said, misinformation about masks. He brought them back to essentially repeat that misinformation and sort of also sort of sidestep the fact that, DeSantis and the experts claimed, we were only, doing what the WHO says in terms of like, they only say it for people that kids above 12 should have masks. And that's simply what we said. They actually pretty much said that like no children should have masks. And one of them said that he doesn't believe that even adults should wear masks. So politically, DeSantis is essentially riding. And you saw this when the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, was here in Orlando. He's riding the idea of, he is the most, anti-shutdown, anti-restrictions governor in the country. And this is sort of playing into that.
This works. This plays among Republican voters, particularly Republican primary voters. Does it play with a general election crowd?
Well, that's the question. The primary voters in both parties are certainly not, the general electorate. They're much more either right wing or left wing. It's quite possible that this could play very well. It plays very well right now with the Republican primary electorate and what they want to see. But it's a real question, whether the general population that just voted for Joe Biden for president is going to, follow DeSantis down that path. And as has been mentioned before, it plays with the crowd right now here in, April of 2021. Like, we don't know what the big issue will be among the Republican electorate in, January, February of 2024. The pandemic might be months or years in the rearview mirror by then. So it's DeSantis sort of, getting out there ahead right now. It doesn't really show like where either both the general electorate or even the Republican electorate is going to be in 2024.
That's a good point. Many miles to go, but call us up right now. 305-995-1800 as we continue with Dr. Jeff Goldhagen and Stephen Limoncello of the Orlando Sentinel. And your tweets as well. We'll get a few of those on the air in a moment here on the Florida Roundup. Let us know your thoughts. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We're talking about some remarks that Governor DeSantis and a group of medical professionals made at the governor's invitational roundtable in March regarding masks. It was on YouTube, and YouTube subsequently decided to delete the video. And the governor has two controversies regarding masks and regarding what he has claimed to be is the stifling of conservative voices on social media. 305-995-1800 to have your voice heard. 305-995-1800 or at Florida Roundup on Twitter. Stephen Lemangelo is still with us, politics editor at the Orlando Sentinel. Dr. Jeff Goldhagen, also with us, professor and chief at the Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at the University of Florida College of Medicine, Jacksonville. Dr. Goldhagen, I wanted to get your thoughts as a science professional about the criticism of YouTube for removing the video of the governor's March roundtable. YouTube said that comments in that video went against the consensus of health professionals and health authorities. Now, on Monday, the governor said YouTube's action brings up this question.
Whether scientific consensus is something that we want to be, you know, governed by in terms of what information is allowed to be out there.
Now, one of the doctors the governor has relied on during these roundtables, the Harvard biostatistician and epidemiologist Dr. Martin Kulldorff, said this.
Science is dependent on free exchange of ideas, and it has been for 300 years now. So if this continues, this kind of attitude with censoring certain scientific views, then I think we have reached the end of 300 years of enlightenment, and that would be very, very unfortunate.
So their argument is that by YouTube deleting the roundtable, they are stifling the free flowing of scientific debate. Dr. Goldhagen, how should the public think about scientific consensus? And do you think YouTube's action stifles legitimate scientific debate?
Well, first of all, let me say that none of those members of that panel were, in fact, medical experts. One was a healthcare economist. One was an epidemiologist. Dr. Kulldorff is a biostatistician. And Scott Atlas is a radiologist. So none of those individuals were medical experts. So I think it's really important that we pull back from that. Yes, in fact, there is a role for scientific discussion and so on, but that is really dependent on the arena in which that happens. That was not the arena that was presented. The arena that was presented was not about scientific discussion. In fact, it was about inappropriate, inaccurate statements that were made in a political environment. There is a role for scientific inquiry and for debate and so on, but that really is the arena. It's arena dependent. So yes, absolutely, we can't yell fire in a movie theater, and we should not be able to have an arena like social media provides where misinformation that directly results in the deaths of tens of thousands of people.
Well, what role?
Yes, they were appropriate for pulling that.
As a medical professional yourself, what role does social media play or should play in the free flow of scientific debate, of legitimate scientific debate? Is that the place for it?
Well, it depends on what you mean by social media. So
Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram.
No.
Okay.
The debate for scientific discussion happens in peer-reviewed journals and in presentations that happen in professional environments.
Stephen Lemangelo with the Orlando Sentinel. We're hearing a pediatric expert give us the facts and the science. At the same time, social media has become a complicating factor in this pandemic, interlaying with the divisive politics of the pandemic. What are your thoughts about critics of the governor who say he's exploiting this environment to give rocket fuel to his presidential aspirations?
Sure, and I think it's sort of being underplayed just how radical these panelists were. You know, three of them were authors of the Great Barrington Declaration, as mentioned before, which calls for herd immunity through infection, essentially just things would be better off, according to this theory, if the
just
virus
let it
just
run wild
ran through the younger population.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is just extremely, extremely radical. And the fact that, you know, DeSantis's panel is, you know, three of those people plus Scott Atlas, who was another, you know, incredibly controversial former Trump advisor pushing for herd immunity. You know, DeSantis has been sort of very careful not to actually straight out say that himself, but he's the fact that he brought these four on as a panel and didn't really have anyone else there to counteract him sort of shows what he thinks about it. And essentially for DeSantis and a lot of his critics would say that he's jumping onto this sort of, you know, very conservative. We don't like masks. We don't like restrictions. We don't like shutdowns, bandwagon. And it goes far beyond, you know, what a lot of, you know, governors have done. So, you know, well, a lot of governors would say, even Democrats, that we don't want too many shutdowns, but we'll have, you know, moderate shutdowns and we'll still have some restrictions. He has straight up said that, you know, he will never have any more restrictions of any kind ever in the state of Florida. No, you know, 50%, going down to 50% in restaurants or bars, for example, just nothing. That's his card, a lot of people think, for, you know, playing that lane in the upcoming Republican presidential primary.
More callers here. Tom is in Tallahassee standing by. Go ahead, Tom. You're on the radio.
Hey, well, I'm very concerned about YouTube's lopsided nature of this debate. They basically decided their opinion is going to hold sway and nobody else's that disagrees with them is. I'm also concerned about the lopsided nature of this panel. I don't see anybody here who's representing, you know, half of the entire population of Florida, who a majority of Floridians who voted for the governor and agree that he's done a better job managing this pandemic than, say, the blue state, which they should be taking on a lot more than this state, which has done exceptionally well during the pandemic. So I think the governor has a good background in this, and I want to hear what he has to say. And a free marketplace of ideas, which a democracy depends on, demands that there be no censorships of these types of things. Now, I know that you say that you have a medical professional, but guess what? There's medical professionals who disagree with him, and we should be able to hear from those people. And they don't have the right to veto everyone else from having the chance to talk about these things and being heard.
Tom, let me unpack a little bit here to explore a little bit more. The video is still online. It's not on YouTube, but it's still publicly available to watch and to see. YouTube is a private company. It can't be compelled to give somebody a forum if it doesn't want to. And in the free marketplace of ideas, doesn't YouTube, as anyone in the marketplace, have the choice to amplify a voice or not amplify a voice and let the marketplace decide?
Yes, but in those situations, we should hold their feet to the fire and say, you know, when you started this thing, you were being presented as something that's going to give everyone an opportunity to reach an audience. You didn't have a little asterisk there saying, unless, of course, you're on the wrong political party or you're giving an opinion that we don't agree with.
Well, in YouTube's defense here, Tom, it did not talk about politics in its decision to pull that video. It spoke specifically about the science. And you did bring up that science, Tom, and that's an important point here. And Dr. Goldhagen, to Tom's point, or contention that 50% or however many percentage of Floridians that voted for Governor DeSantis, which, by the way, voted, of course, before the pandemic, before COVID-19 existed in our world, you know, is the science still debatable here? Tom contends that it is. YouTube is stifling that free flow of information and not allowing those who support that idea to hear that idea.
Well, let me make a very definitive statement. There's no debate about the science. The science is extremely, extremely clear. YouTube took the video down because it wasn't a free market of discussion, because it wasn't. It was a one-sided perspective that gave false information that, used by individuals and by communities, would result in significant increases in the number of deaths of both children as well as adults. So there's no doubt. There's no doubt amongst the scientific community about how COVID is spread and the effectiveness of masks.
Yeah. Dr. Goldhagen, thank you so much for your time. Dr. Jeffrey Goldhagen with the University of Florida, Jacksonville. And Steve Lemangelo, thanks for sharing your reporting with us as well. Steve is the politics editor with the Orlando Sentinel.
Well, this week, the Florida House passed a controversial bill banning transgender athletes from participating in women's and girls' scholastic sports. Supporters of the measure say it's aimed at maintaining the competitive balance in women's sports. Here is House bill sponsor Cale Tuck speaking at a House panel discussion on March 17th. Tuck is a Republican representing an area northwest of Lake Okeechobee.
There are inherent biological differences between men and women. The Fairness in Women's Sports Act supports women and girls by ensuring they have the same opportunities as men and boys to showcase their skill, strength, and other athletic abilities.
Critics call the bill a thinly veiled attempt to marginalize already vulnerable transgender kids. Here's Representative Marie Woodson during the same panel discussion. She's a Democrat representing a part of Broward County.
This bill would only marginalize and demonize the transgender community. If anything, this bill would create more unfairness.
Now, the legislation moving in Tallahassee is part of a national effort on the part of Republican state lawmakers to remove transgender athletes from girls' and women's sports. Florida is one of at least 30 states debating this kind of legislation. A little more info. The House bill states that female sports teams in Florida are specifically for cisgender women and girls, while also creating a path for handling disputes by requiring a medical professional to verify a student's sex. The law would apply to students in K through 12 and higher education. With more, we welcome Gina Duncan, Director of Transgender Equality, Equality Florida, and freelance journalist Brittany Della Creta. Thanks so much to both of you for appearing.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Great to have you both. We need to note we did invite the bill's sponsors to appear today on the Florida Roundup, but did not hear back by airtime. Gina Duncan, let's begin with you. Why is Equality Florida opposed to this bill?
Well, first of all, let me say that it certainly doesn't surprise me that the sponsors of the House bill or the Senate bill did not make an appearance or speak today. When 19 amendments were proposed on the House bill, House Bill 1475, there was not a single amount of debate or discussion from the proponents of the bill. Obviously, Equality Florida, the state's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization, we're concerned about these bills. As you say, these are nationally orchestrated bills that amount to basically a culture war on the transgender community. And as you know, these bills are carefully orchestrated from LGBTQ hate groups across the country. They've been manufactured and dispersed, as you said, to at this point over 30 states across the country. In Florida, these bills have been fast-tracked, and these bills, what makes them so harmful is they're truly a flawed solution looking for a non-existent problem.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Brittany, let's bring you into the discussion. The bill's supporters say that allowing transgender girls and women to compete disrupts the competitive balance in women's sports. They're arguing that trans women athletes have physical advantages over cisgender female athletes. You say that's an inaccurate belief, however, yes?
Yeah, I also think it's much more complicated than people are making it. But the one thing I'm hearing is that this bill applies to athletes in K through 12, and yet we're talking about transgender women. So we are applying these standards to children. But the other thing is, if you look at sports and you look at women's sports, there is no, you know, takeover of trans women dominating women's sports. And trans women have been able to compete at the Olympic level for almost two decades, and not a single one has ever even qualified. In most of the states where these bills are being introduced, lawmakers couldn't name a single trans girl competing in their state. They didn't even know of any. So it's a problem that literally does not exist, and it's being orchestrated as one.
We need to note the NCAA has put states like Florida on notice, warning that if locations don't treat all student athletes with dignity and respect, they could be ineligible to host future championship games. Gina, your thoughts on the legislature at odds with the NCAA on this issue? Florida could potentially lose revenue if this measure passes.
Yeah, this is a huge problem. You know, we saw this in North Carolina, and this bill very much mirrors the flawed concepts that were put forth in reference to anti-transgender bathroom bills. And HB2 that was passed in North Carolina, the NCAA boycotted North Carolina and resulted in almost $5 billion in lost sports revenue The NCAA has already made it very clear that they want to have tournaments, and we know of over 50 NCAA events that are planned over the next 2 years in states that are welcoming and inclusive, not states that are discriminatory and have laws and bills that mean to alienate and demean certain parts of our community.
Brittany, you've written about this community and its vulnerability. More than 50% of kids play sports at some point in their lives. You're arguing that to deny trans kids the opportunity is to deny them a formative experience. Can you talk about that quickly before we go to break?
Absolutely. When we talk about trans inclusion in sports, what we're often centering is asking cis people, cisgender people, how they feel about trans people participating, rather than centering the impacts that transgender inclusion would have on transgender kids who are the most vulnerable. And there's research from the Center for American Progress that shows that not only are cis kids not harmed by competing alongside trans kids, but trans kids are helped immeasurably by being affirmed. They get mental health benefits, social benefits, and decreased suicidality. And those are really, really important. And I think that that gets lost in all of this.
The suicidality is important to note that trans kids are more likely to be at risk of suicide. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yes, they have higher rates of suicidality.
Mm-hmm. And there's been a handful of transgender girls that have played sports in Florida over the last decade or so. Any issues with those athletes?
Break in 20 seconds.
Not that I'm aware of. And the case that is being used in a lot of these arguments as kind of the...
And you'll have to hold that thought. We'll have to hold that thought. Yes. More to come here on the Florida Roundup. Stay with us.
We're back on the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Media. Thanks again for supporting public radio. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. We're continuing the discussion about a bill that's passed the Florida House. It would ban transgender athletes from participating in girls and women's sports in Florida. Give us a call on this, 305-995-1800, tweets at Florida Roundup. As we continue now with Gina Duncan, Director of Transgender Equality, Equality Florida, and Brittany Delacreta, freelance journalist. Brittany, why don't you finish your thought from before the break? Only a handful of transgender girls have played in Florida sports over the last decade. And you mentioned one case in particular?
It's actually a Connecticut case, but it's an important case because it's the one that's being used when a lot of these bills are argued. And in the Connecticut case, three cisgender girls basically sued the state because they competed against two transgender girls. And the argument that these cis girls were making was that they would never be able to beat the trans girls. And not only did one of those cis girls routinely beat one of the trans girls that she said she could never beat, two of the three cisgender girls are now running at the Division I level in college, and both trans girls' careers ended after high school because they did not feel like they could continue to compete. And so it's very clear that even this case that is being used and held up as an example is incredibly flawed and does not show that the trans girls are dominating the cis girls that they're competing against.
It's Tom Hudson. Gina, I'd like you to hear what the sponsor of the House bill, Kaylee Tuck, has said regarding how she characterizes the intent of the bill. This was during the final debate for this legislation in the House earlier this week.
This bill is strictly to preserve the safety, integrity, fairness, and competitiveness of women's sports so that women do not become sideline spectators of their own sports.
So Gina Duncan, Director of Transgender Equality at Equality Florida, how do you hear that characterization? How do you respond?
Well, it's a false premise because we already know that for over a decade, the Florida High School Athletic Association, the NCAA, and even the International Olympic Committee have rules in place that allow everyone to participate. It's not about fairness. This is about a culture war to erase the transgender community. And, you know, we know these bills are an embarrassing overreach. They're extreme, they're unnecessary and illegal because they open so many Pandora boxes. For example,
why illegal? Why illegal, Gina?
Because if you look at the recent Bostock ruling from the Supreme Court that did apply to employment discrimination, they clearly define sex discrimination to include gender identity, gender expression, and transgender status. Based on the definition of transgender status being a protected class, we would see that these bills would be blatantly in violation of Title IX.
Gina, I'd like you to explain and educate our listeners about this community in terms of a concept called gender-affirming care. Can you explain what gender-affirming healthcare is and how it is helping transgender youth and why that is part of this discussion?
Well, I think it's first to understand that what does it mean to be transgender? And what it basically means is someone's gender identity, their deeply held belief of who they are and how they relate to the world does not align with their biological or assigned sex at birth, which is denoted by our genitals. In the bills, they call this biological sex. Your gender identity is not something you choose. Being transgender is not a choice. You are transgender because your gender identity does not align with your physical being. We see that affirming healthcare is also being attacked in various states, and we saw this introduced by Representative Sabatini last year, and it was brutally defeated in a workshop. But affirming care is supporting our at-risk young people, you know, K through 12, before they reach the age of 18. And that may include puberty blockers, hormone therapy, puberty blockers to postpone puberty so that if someone does decide to transition later in life, it will not be as severe. Affirming care also includes healthcare, affirming healthcare of at-risk young people who are being demeaned, marginalized, bullied, and harassed in schools every day. So to strip away affirming healthcare, which we're seeing and could potentially be the next step in Florida, is very wrong and very hurtful to our young transgender youth.
And getting back to the bill at hand, Democratic Representative Michelle Rayner spoke during debate Wednesday before the bill passed 77-40. She represents parts of Hillsborough as well as Manatee, Pinellas, and Sarasota counties.
We talked about genital examinations. And I know for a fact if any member's child would be subjected to what this bill suggests, you would hire the best attorney and you would fight this bill. If we pass this bill in this house, please understand we're legislating state-sanctioned sexual assault against children.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Brittany, you've been writing about the mechanics of what this bill might involve with athletes in this state. What about that accusation?
I think it's right on. These types of genital exams have actually been deemed human rights violations by the United Nations. We are asking parents to subject their children to sexual abuse in order to play the sport that they love. And I think there are also legal issues about this as well, aside from the ethical and moral issues that are around this. But it could be argued that it violates due process rights to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. We are asking people to turn over private medical information and, you know, be violated in order to play sports. And, you know, these are children. And I think especially in women's sports and girls' sports, sexual abuse is already such a problem. And we have spent so long trying to root out sexual abuse from sports. And then this is just asking the state to sanction it.
both of you have mentioned legal challenges you expect this bill to bring up. And I'm wondering, Gina, from Equality Florida, what is the organization prepared to do if this legislation passes and is signed into law in Florida? In other words, what is happening now with the conversations that you're having with Equality Florida and your legal counselors regarding the potential of these of this legislation in Florida?
Well, we're mobilizing with our national partners as these bills, if they are passed, and we do anticipate that they will, unfortunately. But there certainly will be hundreds of thousands of dollars of Florida taxpayer dollars, which will be spent on the litigation of these bills, because they clearly, as the Biden administration has already pointed out, that these bills are illegal, they're discriminatory, and again, they're in violation of Title IX. And we have this most recent codification of sex discrimination from the Supreme Court, which will be interpreted and will be applied to these bills that are, as soon as they're passed, they will be litigated. And after hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent, we anticipate that they will be thrown out.
So, Gina, you mentioned Title IX a few times. Brittany, you've talked about the examination language in the bill as being potentially a source of a legal challenge. Gina, where do you think the biggest vulnerability, legally speaking, is for the language as it currently stands, as lawmakers in Tallahassee are considering it?
Well, that's one of the worst parts of these bills, is that there are a huge overreach. For example, if a competitor or their parents or someone else calls an athlete's sex into question, that student athlete must submit to a genetic test, a testosterone level test, or an examination of their quote, quote, reproductive anatomy. That's what's in the bill. Or a genital inspection. The legislation also allows any students, and this is so broad that it screams litigation, is the legislation allows any student who feels a transgender girl has to deprive them of an athletic opportunity to that they can sue the school for damages, including for any psychological, emotional, or physical harm that they suffered. Broad, impossible to enforce, and speaks to the misuse of what this bill can bring. You know, someone is a bad loser, so they file a complaint that there is someone participating against them that was not female enough, or they feel they want to confirm if they are transgender or not. Those are the kind of doors that this opens, and they're all wrong.
And we do need to note, we did ask the bill sponsors to appear today, but we didn't hear back from them by airtime. I want to thank both of you for talking about this with our listeners. Gina Duncan, she's a director of Transgender Equality, Equality Florida. Brittany Delacreta, freelance journalist. Thank you both so much for appearing on the show today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Padormo are the producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, WLRN's Director of Radio Operations, and our technical director is Peter J. Mertz. We get engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday at noon.